I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
I can't get into a rhythm. Now I just want to sleep all morning instead of doing it all night. And when we're doing this podcast at night, all I want to do is just go to sleep. So I think I just need to go to sleep for the rest of my life.
I'll tell you what, it's very funny. We're doing the school at home now. So my daughter, my youngest, her teachers, in the beginning, her teacher was doing these daily videos about, like, you know, kind of recapping what the assignments were and where they could find resources. And then the video started coming every couple days. And then my daughter was getting freaked out because she hadn't seen a video from him for a while. I'm like, trust me, it's just discipline is just kind of waning across the board. And sure enough, we got one today. And he was dressed a lot more casually. And he had a little bit of a 5 o'clock shadow. And he was just kind of like seemed a little checked out. I'm like, it reminded me of, I don't know. I watched the old Star Trek series, and they'd always have like these science officers stranded on a planet doing like video logs as they over the course of time, as like they're the rest of their population is getting killed off by some weather system or some predator, and it's just like every day they check in, and it would be like more and more frantic, and their hair's out of place, and they're wild eyed, and it's just, I don't know. I kind of feel like that.
That does kind of seem appropriate.
It's pretty normal for me.
Yeah, but you're sitting
on right now. I mean, really, it's pretty normal. I don't go very many places or do much.
Yeah, but you're senile and old.
Or associate much.
So how are we all holding up? Do we have any exciting things to talk about while we're on shutdown?
Ooh, not too much. Not too much going on. Just really just making sure that we're making the best of this time and using the time I have with my family to just, build some good connections and memories and really just savor every day, man. It's a good reminder that everything is very fleeting. So nothing special.
So with that, we can jump right into the stuff to get cleared up in the beginning. And one of the other podcasts that I listened to, they had a really, really neat idea. And I've said this in the past that it actually does make a difference if you have a lot of people rate and review your podcast, whether it's 5 stars or whether it's 1 star. The more reviews that you get on Apple Podcasts, the more likely you are to be given as a suggested podcast to other listeners. So I do think it's kind of less relevant for a pool podcast because nobody's going to listen to pool if they're not interested in pool. But to give myself the best chance of maybe bringing in new people, maybe somebody hates their life enough to want to listen to a pool podcast and that gets them interested in pool. Who knows? So what they did on their podcast was they actually went through and they actually read those Apple reviews on the podcast. And that they said that was actually working to get more people to give Apple reviews. So I am going to do that as well. I'm going to read one review per week, and I'll probably just go chronologically in order. I don't really know how to separate it, but
where do you get these from?
These are on the Apple Podcast. So Apple Podcasts. And I'm going to read all of them that I come across, whether they're good, whether they're bad, or whether they're indifferent. And it's just basically to try to get some more people to give reviews and ratings. So we will start out with Rob Moreau. And he says, I am a 29-year-old New York Tap League and APA League player. Found this podcast by searching billiards. Listened to one episode and I'm hooked. The mix of Rob and Nate seems perfect. Always love listening to a seasoned player, and Nate does a great job producing great content. Keep up great work, guys. Yay. Glad this was back from January 16th. So I think that was that pre-Demetrius? No.
Yes.
No. You've been around longer than that, haven't you?
I wasn't a regular part of the show. So you guys get all the credit.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to read one per week. It's going to be in the beginning. We'll get it out of the way right away. And this is actually probably a perfect one to start with. This was just the most recent one in the queue. So I guess it's it just seems to be perfect. But he found it just by searching billiards. And if he did that maybe a year ago when I was just starting out the podcast and I had no ratings or reviews, I don't think that that actually would have showed up. So it's pretty cool that you can kind of see some of these ratings actually working and they actually show up in the searches. So that's why we're doing this, but that's pretty much the only reason. It's just another way to potentially get some more eyeballs onto the podcast. And so we can move on from there. The next thing I'll talk about was there was a bunch of Facebook Live interviews that I have done recently. If you do not have a Facebook and you still would like to watch those, they are all on YouTube. I uploaded them right after I did them. So I did one with Emily Frazier. I did one with Emily Frazier and Roy from Roy's Basement. I also did one with Rodney Morris. And I did one with April Larson and Jennifer Beretta on Women in Pool. So those are always on the YouTube page as well as all of the other videos that I make. It's actually kind of neat. I'm starting to get a pretty decent collection of videos over there. There's like 20-something of them already. So kind of cool. More content if you guys want it. And other than that, we can jump into the shout-outs. That's all I got in the beginning. So, Rob, would you like to go first?
Yeah. You know, I really want to shout out. These are tough times we're in, and everybody's kind of doing their best. And there's some people out there. I have been out a few times in the last 31 days now. I've been home. I've been out maybe 4 times. And one of the times I went out was to a grocery store. And there was just a lot of workers in the store stocking shelves and doing their job. And I thought to myself, you know, gee, without them, without these stock folks at the grocery store, we'd be in a lot of trouble. I mean, if they decide, well, I don't want to go to work because it's too dangerous, and just said to their employer, well, most employers are going, if you don't want to come, if you think it's too dangerous, you can get unemployment. I won't stop that. But they're not. They're going to work. And so that's my shout out. My shout out is to all the folks out there, really in the world. I mean, our podcast goes around the world. I mean, and they're doing this in all countries. And if you're a stocker, and I don't care if you're working in a grocery store or working in a retail store of any type or anybody that's putting stuff on shelves, I'm going to shout out to you, today on this podcast. You're doing a great job. You're putting your life on the line, and I just want to thank you.
I can echo that. Demetrius, do you want to go next?
Yeah, I was torn between doing a group shout out or an individual. I'll do a hybrid. I'd like to shout out to a gentleman, Tim Majors, and to the group that there's a lot of folks out there, and what makes me think of Tim is that, you know, I've gotten to know him here over the last few weeks just a little bit, and he's one of these gentlemen that he is a very, I guess, it's like a solo, kind of a, he's on a kind of a solitary journey. I mean, he's got a job where he works a lot by himself, and, you know, he pushes himself really, really hard. You know, he holds himself to a high standard. And it may not be visible to the rest of the world. He may not be, you know, he may not be posting stuff to where, you know, everyone on Facebook, he's putting on, you know, displays to where it's motivating him to put on a performance for the rest of the world. He may not, you know, not everybody in the world's watching him or what he does, but it's important to him. He has a purpose and he knows what his purpose is and he's working hard. And so that to me is really inspiring. You know, a big part of pool is the social element and where we fit and, you know, the different hierarchies that we do battle and how we achieve goals in relationship to our opponents and, you know, the competition. And so in a time when we're kind of separated from all that, I think it really, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are just kind of quietly faced with the decision about whether they just kind of lose their momentum and their focus and let time pass and come out the other side of this thing, you know, worse than when they came in versus deciding that they're going to be disciplined and they're going to rise to the challenge of finding new ways to motivate themselves and engage themselves and keep pushing to be the best person they can be in the circumstances we're in. And that's, I think, really, really important right now. And Tim has been doing a really good job of kind of setting out written goals of what he expects from himself, pushing himself to hit those goals and try to be a little bit better every day than he was the day before, whether that's on the table or off. And so I think that's really important. Tim's been kind of an inspiration to me in that way. And so wanted to shout out to Mr. Tim Majors.
For sure. I'll give a shout out to Tyler and Chris. And that was because they just finished their matchup this past weekend, and it was just amazing to be able to watch them pool, and some really competitive pool too. It was back and forth throughout the first 2 days, and you know, we'll talk about it in a little bit, so I'm not going to go into depth, but it was just really fun to be able to watch something and sweat it all weekend. So it was nice, and thank you to Tyler and Chris for putting that on for us. And with that, we can move on to the rest of the podcast. So I just kind of hinted, of course, that we were going to be talking about the Tyler and Chris matchup. And in conclusion, day one, Tyler finished the day up 33-24. The second day, Chris made a big comeback, but Tyler down the stretch kind of pulled away a little bit. I think he won 13 of the last 15 games or 14 of the last 16 games, something like that, and ended up 66-60 on the day. And then Tyler's break just, I mean, it just started coming on, and he was playing six ball with ball in hand positioning on the one ball on day three, and it was truly something to watch. And Tyler ends up clearing out the set 100-75. So does anybody have any initial thoughts on the match before we jump into the nitty gritty details?
Yeah. It was, I did watch some of it, probably a third of it. Anyhow, I was having trouble getting it for some reason. I would get it and it would shut down, and then I'd get it and it would shut down. So I didn't watch all of it, but it reminded me a lot of the Filler and Arenas matchup going to 100. It was real eerily kind of similar.
That's a good observation, Rob.
In what happened within the matches and how hard it is to maintain the quality of your game if you're a little bit of the underdog, and then the guy who's favored, of course, is breaking like a monster. And, you know, he does have 4, 5, 6 ball runouts instead of 9, 8 or 9. We saw what happens, especially with position on one. So, that's what I took away. I did make some notes too that I'll talk about after in a little bit here, but that was my initial observation.
So this is, like, I knew Tyler's break was good, and I always knew that Tyler's break was like top five in the world kind of good. I think he might have the best break in the world. He did not have a single dry break until day three, and he finished with 2 total dry breaks. Out of 100 breaks, he had 2 dry breaks. On my best day breaking, I'll have 2 dry breaks in the first 6. Like, it is absolute... No, that does not count scratching. It just counts dry breaks. But only 2 dry breaks is just absolutely crazy. And I have the statistics of his break too. I think he was.
I've got now the one I'm looking at here is from AZ Billiards. It says that he had, now the definition of a successful break is one in which he pocketed a ball, at least one ball, and did not foul.
And that was,
and it said he was 91%. 91 out of 100 breaks, he pocketed at least one ball, did not foul.
That is insane. Here. Like, I mean, that is, I'm an amateur player. I mean, everybody knows this by watching my videos. I am definitely an amateur player. I think that if I can have like a 60 to 70% success rate on my breaks, I think that's pretty good. A 91% is like otherworldly. I just can't even fathom that.
You know, think back though, Nate. Think back at tournaments you've played, in amateur tournaments you've played, in the ones where you've won and dominated, and then take a look at that percentage again. I bet you it's up there. You know, maybe not 90, but it's high.
Yeah.
If you analyze that closely.
I mean, if I'm playing bar box 8-ball and I make a ball and I'm playing well, I expect to run out. So if I'm going to win a tournament, I'm probably breaking a ball in.
Yeah.
Well, and there's another statistic, which is the number of break and runs. And Tyler Steyer, out of 100 breaks, he ran out 40 racks from his break. And so that puts him at 40%, which is actually the same gentleman has compiled the statistics on all these races to 100. Filler versus Aranis, Filler ran out 40%. Shane versus Dennis, Shane ran out 52 out of 119 for 44%. And when Shane played Shaw, he ran out 47 out of 101 for 47%.
That's
so huge. In general, when Shane has played races to 100, his break and run percentage has been somewhere between 40 to 45%. This one match, he hit 47%, but usually it's in the low 40s. And so, you know, we've always said, you know, if you don't have a 40% break and run percentage, need not apply to play Shane, because it's just, you know, like with Dennis, you know, Dennis played well, but he just, yeah, if you can't break and run 40%, then you're just giving up too many games. Because one of the interesting things was going back to Chris versus Tyler, you know, if Tyler broke and ran 40 racks for 40%, Chris broke and ran, he broke 75 times, and he ran out 14 times from his break, which was 19%. Mm-hmm. And if you look, 40 break and runs versus 14 break and runs, there was a difference of 26 break and runs. And if you look at the final score, there was a difference of 25 racks. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that that's basically the margin was the difference in runouts for the break. And I will tell you, I've played many, many matches, and I've noticed that the matches I lose, it's often the break and runs oftentimes equate to the difference. Like I remember I played Shane one day, we played 10 sets, just kind of sparring around. And if you added up all the scores, the sets that he won, which was most of them, the difference was not all that much, except that, like, he was beating me 7-4, 7-5, 7-6, 7-4. And if you look at, I'm sure if we were playing for more, he might have added a game to this. But the difference is, I mean, I might run one rack a set, he'd run three, and then he'd beat me by two racks. And it was again and again. And meanwhile, the matches I've won against top players have oftentimes been, you know, if I beat a top player 11-6 or 11-7 or 11-5, oftentimes I look back and I'm like, yeah, that's because I ran three off the leg and then managed to nurse my three rack lead to the finish line. So it's not surprising to me. Oftentimes it works out where the number of break and runs difference, the difference between the number of break and runs between the two players oftentimes equates to the margin, because both players play good. And so it just a few different ways of looking at how important that break is.
Yeah, for sure. Man, it was pretty exciting to watch Tyler break. It's just every single time that cue ball is on a rope back 3 feet, and then it just, you know, you can see the spin that is like slowing the cue ball down and then just eventually stopping it as the one ball whips by it to sit down nicely into the top left corner. It was something to behold. Every single time you could almost take a pencil, put it on the TV screen where the cue ball is going to end up, and it would be within, you know, 2 to 3 inches of, you know, table space away from that spot. It was crazy.
It looked a lot like Filler's break.
No, and you know this what? This was better than Filler's break. I mean, Filler. Well, go ahead, Demetrius.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just excited to say this. I really wanted to point this out. Is that actually, yeah, to your point, yeah, it's better because if Filler broke and ran 40% against Aranis, and Tyler broke and ran 40% against Robinson, well, we know two things. We know that Filler is a league of his own after the break in terms of runout ability. I mean, his runout game is, you know, nothing against Tyler. It's just Filler's in a league of his own. And then meanwhile, we also know that Tyler, and we can get into this, did not always play his best pool throughout the match.
No.
In the end, the fact that Tyler is not at the same level as Filler in terms of after the break runout and didn't necessarily perform his best throughout the whole match, and yet he still managed to run out the same number of racks as Filler did, that shows that he was two balls better than Filler on the break. And Filler, and that was after watching a performance by Filler where we said that he could break with Shane. You know what I mean? So
right. Yeah, it was phenomenal to watch that, for sure. Yeah, just more balls went in. I think he made, what, 5 balls? One rack, didn't he? I think he made 5.
Yeah.
Half the balls.
I saw him. He was regularly potting 3 balls.
Yeah.
I think his overall average, he averaged 2.0 balls per break.
Sheesh.
And that is, I mean, do we remember what Filler's was? I thought it was, it like 1.8 or something like that?
Well, I think Aranis and Filler, like Aranis had 0.4 more. I think it was in 1.8 and 1.4 for Filler, something like that.
Yes. Somewhere along those lines. But
could have been 2+.
Yeah, am I crazy in saying that Tyler has the best break in the world? Who else can? Maybe Chang?
I've never seen anything like it. It's just, yeah, he's 2.0 balls per break. And if it was just the number of falls, that'd be one thing. But I think that his 40% break and run, like I said, you know, given that he was kind of, you know, half the match, he was on his B game, and to still convert at the same levels as a Shane or a Filler, given that he is a lower rated player, not always on his best game, I think that speaks volumes. I think that if Filler had the opportunities that Tyler had off the break, he might have run 60 out of 100. You know what I mean? I just don't think that.
Oh yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone generate that many opportunities. And it's not that it's not a one hot day either. We saw this back, and I don't remember if it was, you know, which 10 ball championship it was. I thought it was the one where Cole won last year. But anyway, I saw Tyler playing deep in that event, and you know, it shows how he can win these big 10 ball events. I mean, nobody has to like playing this guy, you know. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, I can remember. This is many years ago now, when I was playing another amateur player, and he was a good player, and he got to kind of whining a little bit, because he was, after, you know, 30 games or whatever, he sat there and he said, you know, we were playing 8-ball, and he said, I've only broken run like 7 or 8, you know, out of these 30 games. And I went, well, man, that's pretty good. I went, that 7 or 8, I said, that's like 25%. And he goes, well, that's not very good. And I said, well, you know how much, what the average of a pro is. And this is like 25 years ago or so. And I had heard it somewhere on something, or read it somewhere, that it was about around 30% for a professional pool player to break and run a third, roughly, or a little less than a third of all the racks he breaks for 8-ball. And I told that to this guy, and he says, really? And I went, yeah. So really, if you're at 28%, 27 or 28, you're pretty darn good for an amateur. So I feel good about that. I was trying to straighten him out, because, you know, he felt, you know, if he should be running half of the racks that he breaks.
Yeah, that's just way off. Yeah, that's way off. So
yeah.
So I would like to get into this discussion now, and maybe we can head back to some of the details of the match later, because there's one big incident that I think would be worth talking about. But so this discussion comes up all the time on Facebook, on AZ Billiards, basically anywhere where there's a forum, and it's who's the greatest pool player of all time. And I don't think we'll open this up for discussion, but it always comes down to basically the new age people now versus the you know, the older school players back then. And so when you ask who is like the greatest track and field person maybe in history, a lot of people would say Jesse Owens. Well, if you say Jesse Owens and you put him up on a 100-meter dash against Usain Bolt these days, Usain Bolt just kills him. It's not even close. He's probably finishing a full second ahead of him. And the only reason I bring that up is because Jesse Owens might be the greatest track and field person in the history of the game. But if you compare him to the people from now, there's just no competition. And I only start with the Jesse Owens reference because back in the 90s and early, and even earlier than that, nobody cared about the breaks. I mean, you walked up there and you hit him as hard as he possibly could and hoped for the best. Efren did that. Earl did that. Johnny, everybody just basically cracked the rack as hard as he could, see what happens, and maybe you have a shot and maybe you don't. Now, this break from the players these days, it's so perfected to the point where you can literally squat the rock and expect to have the one ball within a 1-foot circle of a point. So unless you're going to make the argument that the players now are significantly worse at cueing the ball, I don't think you can argue that there's higher highs that have ever been reached than the players that are, you know, out there competing today. What do you guys think of that?
Well, I think that's pretty accurate. And you have to go, you know, if you were going to make this statement, you'd have to go by eras. Who's the greatest player of the, you know, the not the overall, the modern era, but who's the greatest player of the 30s, the 40s, 50s, 60s? You'd have to go through that like that. Because that's what we see, like Demetrius talked about. He says you go through a peak in your pool playing career where you're dominant for a, a few years, and you're good before that and good after that. But that dominant, you know, 3, 4, 5 years is in an era somewhere. And Earl and Mika and all those guys went through that dominant Shane, you know, that dominant, that peak time. Can they get it back and come back? Can they have, you know, 10 years down the road, have another Jack Nicklaus 1986 Masters? Yeah. Yeah, these guys can do that. They can come back. You see, Earl's still doing it all the time, you know, going deep in tournaments against all these young guns. So
my thought on, you know, the greatest of all time, you've got to be really clear on what we're talking about, because when we're talking about the greatest of all time, we have to either talk about, we can say that the technical execution has improved, you know, like John Schmidt has a higher run than Moscone, or the break and run percentage has increased, therefore the highest number of racks run is going to be higher today than it was in the past. And in terms of, you know, so in terms of technical performance, and there's a couple reasons for that, of course. One is that the equipment has changed, you know, so we're using template layouts on newer cloth and things like this. And then there's also the fact that there's tremendous amounts of information. The players that are up and coming know, I mean, Tyler Steyer, when he's growing up, knows exactly how Shane plays from YouTube, and he can build his game saying, okay, he needs to reverse engineer it. What game do I need to put together to beat this guy? And he has a very clear picture and model, as well as the knowledge and to kind of start designing and hit the game that he wants to achieve. Whereas, you know, back in the 60s, players would just kind of have to figure it out from running the roads and picking up a trick here and there. So between knowledge, opportunity, and changes in equipment, that is going to allow a higher level of game to develop. So of course, the players today are playing technically better. I think the players that are, you know, defensive about this, there's a different question, which is, you know, so the first question is, who's playing the technically best pool of all time? But then the other question is, who is the greatest player? And if the greatest player means, we have to look at which players, given the opportunity they had with the opponents they faced, which players were able to rise above their conditions, their opportunities, their opponents, and dominate the game and evolve the game and take it to a level that had not been seen before. And so Willie Moscone was able to rise above his opponents and dominate at straight pool in a way that John Schmidt has not been able to rise above and dominate straight pool in today's age. You know, and maybe Luther Lassiter, and I don't know, but I mean, I never saw him play, but maybe Luther Lassiter was able to rise above. And nine ball, I mean, it was a relatively new game. You know, people had just started playing it 10, 20, 30 years before. And he was the first player to take it to a level where he was beating everyone in the country. So maybe he rose above the game and played it dominantly in a way that today's players can't dominate over everybody else. And so I'm not, and part of that then is, of course, he didn't face the same opposition that today's players. So it's a tricky subject. My whole point, though, is, of course, today's players are technically playing better for a number of reasons. But I think the people that defend the old-time players, they're defensive because they're saying that the players today aren't transcending their competition to any higher of a degree than Moscone or Lassiter or the players before us did. And so then they say things like, well, if you'd put today, you know, Filler and Shane, put them in a pool room in the 30s or 40s with no internet and old cloth and, you know, triangle racks, you know, how would that match out? Or if you could bring yesterday's players and give them new equipment and give them the opportunity to grow up again. But you can't do that. So in the end, you know, Rob said you have to compare by eras. I look at it more as which players transcended the game, which players took the game to a new level and was able to dominate their competition better than their opponents. And today's players may not be able to dominate their competition to the same extent because the levels of competition are so high. But then that just means that it requires less of a dominant performance to be noteworthy. So Filler's performance may not be the same as Moscone winning 16 world championships in a row or whatever it was, but what Filler's done nonetheless is pretty legend status. And so in the end, I think my whole case is, it's a silly comparison to make because in the end, of course, the game is going to get technically better executed. But if what we're recognizing when we talk about great is human spirit and human transcendence and generational talent, then there have been generational talents every generation, and they're all, to me, equally important part of pool history. And to try to compare the two, it doesn't even make sense to me. But that's my opinion.
I got to agree with that totally. It really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, no, I definitely do as well. The reason for bringing it up anyway in general was just I don't think that you could look over the history of pool and look at a 40 to 47% runout percentage in the history of pool going back, you know, 10 years in before. It's just over the course of 100 games to break and run, you know, 40 racks is just absolutely insane to think about. And a lot of it was for the reasons that you said. There's no template rack. There's the balls are dirty.
Right.
Sometimes the pockets were a little bit tighter. I think back in the 90s and 80s, I think you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. On the nine ball tables, I think that they like to make those a little bit tighter than what they are today. Am I wrong on that?
Well, some of the pockets were, I don't know that the pockets were tighter, and sometimes they were looser. But I'll tell you, you know, with the slow cloth, when you have to jam the balls in the hole, it made, I mean, you know, people talk about a lot of the gold crowns actually had pockets that might have been a little bit softer than the diamonds today. But right. The difference was they had worn cloth. And what that means is when you get a flat angle on a ball, or, you know, you have to move the cue ball around the table, you really had to shoot those balls firm. And so if I think about an example, if you have a ball laying on the side rail and your cue ball is 4 or 5 feet away and a little bit out, and you have to run that ball down the rail with low outside English and draw the cue ball back up the table. On these diamonds with slidey cloth, you could just aim it, cue it low, and use a normal swing, and the cue ball just kind of sucks back because it's slidey cloth, and it's just a diamond, you know. But back in the old day, you really had to, I mean, you had to pure those balls and snap them in the hole, and just really, they'd rattle out. You know, those were really, really tester shots. And so I just think that, you know, and Nick Varner, I remember him talking about the slow equipment and how he misses just the slow equipment because he said it really, he's like, I always liked that slower equipment. It really forced you to play the right angles because if you got flat on a ball, you were dead. You couldn't just pound a cue ball around the table. Whereas with the diamonds and the fast rails and the slidey cloth, you know, you get a little flat on a ball, you just swing through it a little bit. It still gets where you're going. So, anyway, the pockets weren't any tighter, but I think that the cloth conditions really made it, you know, a lot of times when they broke, there was a lot of congestion after the break, a lot of clusters. And then, and it was very difficult to move. I mean, playing rotation, especially, I mean, straight pool, they could play, but playing rotation where you have to move the cue ball around the table, it was much, much harder to move the cue ball around the table.
So then, one other thing I would like to talk about for this set. I have never seen this in my entire 20-something years of playing this game, 24 years of playing this game. I have never seen anybody, nonetheless a professional player, and this was kind of when Tyler was really grinding through his struggles on day two. I've never seen any player in history get three fouled twice in a row. Have you guys ever seen anything like that?
I have not.
Nope.
That is, and Tyler had some real opportunities to get hits, but as a whole, he was kicking at really tough balls. But he did have about, I think two of the six, he had a very, very realistic shot of getting a kick. The only reason I bring this up to talk about it is basically just to give you a platform, Demetrius. Tell us what's going through Tyler's mind when he's trying, you know, on that. Right after you get three fouled, and then the next three shots, he just looked helpless. I mean, he looked like he didn't have a chance if the ball was 6 inches across to be able to get a hit on that. What was going through his mind, and what is, you know, how do you battle through and get out of that?
Yeah, there is no question. I actually wanted to talk about that, is that Tyler was really struggling on day two, and to me, this is one of those things that's a difference between, I think this came out a little bit with Mora and Bergman. You know, this is not a tournament set. And so in a tournament set, when you play a race to 11 and you're Tyler Steyer, I mean, maybe not everybody feels this way, but when you're Tyler Steyer and you play a race to 11, you feel that you can beat anybody in the world, and you can't, and he can beat anybody in the world in a race to 11. There's no question. And so, belief doesn't necessarily enter the equation to the same extent. Now, because you're not thinking, do I have what it takes to beat this player? Now, when you're not Tyler Steyer, I understand a lot of the people in the audience, I myself included, are not, you know, necessarily top pros where we just, you know, have this overwhelming confidence that we could beat anyone in the world. But maybe you can learn from this, is in a race, you know, a race to 11, Tyler Steyer feels against anybody in the world, he doesn't have to worry about how good they shoot. when he's playing James Aronis or when he's playing, you know, Alex Pagliarini, and they make a great shot and a great run out, he's not thinking, man, how am I supposed to beat this guy? He's just like, yeah, I know they're a great player. I don't have to worry about that. I just have to play my game and see if I happen to get to 11 first. But when you play a money match, and when somebody calls you out and says, I think I can beat you, I don't think you're as good as me, and then you get in the ring and you're going to be playing them for 3 days for 100 games, now you have to start answering that question. This, I talked a little bit about how Aronis was maybe going to be having to deal with some of this against Filler, even though it may have looked like he had to because he plays so well and he's so advanced as a pool player. But everyone struggles with belief. And when you're playing a guy and in a race to where we're going to find out who the better player is, and I understand there's always, you could say it can go either way on a given day, but really it's like we're going to find out now who's better. And when you see your opponent doing things that are very intimidating, or and so what did Chris do that was so intimidating to Tyler? And I'll tell you, in my opinion, what I've seen this happen a lot of times is when you're a great player and you deliver a knockout punch. You know, you get up there, you break really good, you run a bunch of racks, you play technically perfect pool, you get a big lead. You know, Tyler got ended day one, 33-24. He kind of hit Chris with a knockout punch. In other words, he sent a message to Chris saying, I have proven that I'm the better player. I outbroke you, I outplayed you, I outscored you. And Chris came back and said, yeah, hashtag unconvinced. He's I'm not convinced. And so the funny part is, what did Chris do to fight his way back in that set? And in my opinion, the biggest thing that Chris did was he stared at Tyler and said, yeah, I'm still the better player. You may play better. You may break better. You may be able to outscore me, but I'm going to win just because I'm going to look you in the eye and say, I have more belief and you don't have what it takes to put me away. And I'm going to come back and win anyway, despite the fact that I'm outmatched. And something about that dynamic is very, very challenging when you're in a money match. And I think that it's like a game of chicken. It's like it had some impact on Tyler because Tyler's like, what happens when you're the better player and you hit somebody with your knockout punch and all the players that he normally spars with, you know, you hit someone with a knockout punch, they don't get back up. Here he hit Chris and Chris just got up and said, yeah, I don't care. I'm just going to keep playing. I'm going to beat you anyway. And all of a sudden Tyler, it puts you in a spot where, well, what am I going to do? I hit this guy with my knockout punch. He didn't go down. He's still coming at me. What's my game plan now? Now, the right answer to that is I don't need to knock him out. I just need to outscore him. I don't need to get this guy to admit defeat. I don't need this guy to quit. I don't need Chris to fall apart and start dogging it. I'm just going to keep executing my plan. I don't need him to surrender. I just need to keep doing what I do until I get to 100. But it doesn't feel that way when you're in the heat of battle. When you hit somebody with a knockout punch and they come back at you, it can rattle you. And I think Tyler hit Chris with a knockout punch on day one. Chris showed a total resilience and lack of intimidation. And I think it rattled Tyler. And Tyler's like, what do I got to do to get this guy to show some defeat? And then he starts making his game about trying to get Chris to break down or show some humility. And Chris ain't going to back down. That kid's got fire in his belly. I think it rattled Tyler in some way. And he really struggled. And so it shows the pressure in a money match is totally different than the pressure at a tournament. These are the things that come into play is belief in yourself, focus on, you know, delivering your game versus what you're trying to do to the other guy. And Tyler was really up against it. And it played out in some ways that I know he wasn't happy about, but it was really good for him as a growing thing. And then the cool part was just through technical skill, he was able to hold it together and start pressing hard. And then on day three, you could see that he was there to play his game, and you saw what he was able to do. And I've also seen this. Well, I've gone through this, and I know how it works. And so once Tyler was able to regain his footing, that he wasn't there anymore to try to break Chris down or get him to admit defeat, he would just settle for getting to 100 first and playing his game. I could see the diff come back, and I could see the different outcome. And so I think that's a little bit about what that dynamic was. I think that's why he was struggling so much. And I think that what it took to play through that was quit trying to get Chris to admit you're the better player and just prove it on the table and just beat the guy.
Tremendous insight into the difference between, you know, a tournament play and a cash game. There certainly is more of that particular mental one-on-one competitive juices. It seems in a tournament you don't have time for that, but a race to 100? here I've got this to throw out you at because what I did see in the games that I saw experience making a statement. I saw being in a situation where it's on the Moscone Cup. I think Tyler that whatever that did for his game, it was a lot. It pushed him. It pushed him. Just being in that Moscone Cup situation, and the, what he went through to get there, what he did, the work he put in to get there, and I chalked that up, of course, as experience. And then when I looked at these two guys playing each other, I said to myself, especially when I saw some mistakes on position being made, that not only choice of
the point, I think this is some part of something bigger, which is I think that, you know, and both players have a lot in common as far as they're both playing all the tournaments, they're both playing every day, they're both putting in a lot of work, they're both taking care of themselves, and they're approaching the game really well. But I do feel like there are people that are naturally very, very confident, and there are people that are naturally, you know, that don't have that same natural confidence or swagger. And so both can work in a different style. And so the challenge for people that are not very, you know, that don't have a lot of, you know, natural confidence, and I don't know if Tyler's like that, but my read is that Tyler did not, you know, come into the world thinking everything I do is magic. So, but what he did is he said to himself, I'm going to have to outwork everybody. I'm not, you know, I'm nothing special innately. I'm going to have to make myself something special by the difference between what I put into this game versus what other people put in. And he put in hard work on the break, hard work on his game, hard work on putting himself in pressure situations and preparation and diet and exercise. He's out. He's like, I am going to earn it. It's not going to be given to me. I'm not entitled to it. I'm going to earn it. And it shows that even if you don't, I'm not saying Tyler struggles with belief because he's a confident guy, but he's earned that confidence because of the work he's put in and the results that he's seen come from that work. And Chris strikes me as the kind of guy that has more natural confidence, that has a lot of swagger and a lot of belief. And so his challenge then, that is an advantage, okay, because it's in some ways. But then in order to make sure that it doesn't become it can become a disadvantage if you start to feel like you're entitled to stuff without having to earn it. And so Chris doesn't do that. Chris puts in the work too. But I think Tyler's, you know, there was one part where, and maybe it was a little orchestrated during a player interview where, you know, where Chris said something like, Tyler's still this insecure, you know, player that's going to, I'm just going to beat him, to kind of beat him on confidence. And I think, you know, that goes a little bit to what happened on day two. But in the end, also what it goes to show is that confidence or no confidence, the pool balls at some point don't care. The pool balls care about, you know, when you put in the work and you know how to do things, then your skill set will carry you through a tough situation. So day two shows that confidence and belief. And if you're lacking, it is a mental game. And if you're lacking in those areas, you could pay for it. But yet you can always fall back on the skills you develop. And if you work hard enough, then you can earn both the skills and the confidence, and they can support each other and come together in a heck of a way. So Tyler's playing a great game, man.
Yeah, you got to like it. You had to enjoy watching that, the execution in these games. I did have another question, though, for you guys on the match that we were talking about, the main one that – Robinson and Steyer. Is there anything? Now, we know what we were impressed with when we watched them play. They each were impressive players and did everything really good. Is there anything that either one of you noticed or were not impressed with the way they did in their game during the match?
Well, I mean, I would say I think there's two things that Tyler does significantly better than Chris. And the only significantly kind of sounds disrespectful, but I guess hear me out. And the only reason I say significantly is because I think that Tyler might be the best in the world at both of them, if not, you know, very, very near the top. Tyler breaks the balls significantly better than Chris, and he has an extreme stroke. And what I mean by extreme means like his ability to use extreme low left and right Englishes. To really, really make the cue ball do things that doesn't even seem possible to be able to do on a pool table. Now, with that being said, I do think that Chris shoots better than his break for his level. And what I mean by that is Chris shoots the balls a lot straighter than a 745 to 750 Fargo. A match like this for Chris would be really, really important on really, really giving him that fire to be able to say, okay, my break is a trouble area for me. Let's take some time. Let's fix it. Let's work that out and let's get that up to where it needs to be. And I think if he does that and he increases his break by two balls maybe in the next 6 months, I think that automatically raises his Fargo 20 points just from having that bigger break and better break.
Neat.
Yeah, I saw areas where they could improve. Chris with the break, I think that the level of kicking and safety play was good, but it wasn't elite. And then there was also some ball pocketing stuff that was at times not elite. But then that's the thing is we're comparing them to elite. And so I don't really look at it that way. I look at it like if I wanted to play either one of them, if I wanted to get in the ring and play them, I don't bring anything to the table that these guys don't do. And they have some tools that I struggle with. And it would be a heck of a hard match for me to play either one of them in a race to 100 because they're both confident, playing all the time. They don't miss many balls. They run out like water. They both hit little patches with confidence or with ball pocketing or with safeties or whatever. But to me, I saw imperfections, but I think they're both phenomenal players and they're both getting better at a scary rate. So I didn't really see anything wrong other than just this is what world champions look like just before they start winning world championships. That's all I was thinking.
Yeah,
sure.
And I would like to clarify one thing that I said really quickly too. When I say that Chris is going to jump up 20 Fargo's points, the reason I say that is because I think that his shooting is already there. And I think one of the only reasons that isn't quite up there as far as the actual number is because that break is such a pivotal point of his game to where if he got the break basically to, where it needs to be at for his level, that alone is going to be the difference to getting him up there. Because that is just, he shoots the balls extremely straight. He missed significantly less balls than Tyler did. And granted, he had less table time because he lost, he only got the 75 wins, but he only missed, was it 41 balls that he missed that entire set?
Let's see here. He missed 46 balls and Tyler missed 70. Yep.
Yeah, so he only missed 46 balls. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Chris shoots the ball so straight.
He wasn't shooting as many racks, though. So that's one of the reasons that number's skewed.
So now
175 the racks.
Yeah, but they have, that's a very good point. So now they've got it broken down by games at the table. Thank you, Brian.
Right.
He's got 46 misses in 135 games, which means he missed one ball every 2.9 games. Tyler missed 70 in 161 games, so he missed one ball every 2.3 games. So it's about a 20% difference, or 25% difference, depending on which way you count the difference. So
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So
a telling stat there.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll cut this off there, and we'll move on to the next part of the podcast. We have nothing to talk about coming up. There's been a match that's been announced between Justin Bergman and Joshua Filler, but it's almost a month away. So it is a month away. So we won't talk about that yet. A lot of things can happen from now until then, and I don't even know exactly what rules they're playing by. But I will just say one thing, and we can maybe discuss it extremely briefly, but the rules have not yet been announced, and the only thing that I would say is if it's just like straight BCA rules or BCAPL rules or whatever, just straight up 8-ball rules, any variation of that, VNEA, whatever you want to say, I think Filler is the big favorite. But I think if they switch this to take what you make, 8-ball, patterns come really, really, really largely into effect on whether or not you can break and run a lot of racks where it's take what you make or take what you make the most of. Did either one of you have any thoughts on that as to how this matchup goes, given just straight rules or take what you make?
I think that the straight rules, I agree that the straight rules would be more of a favorite for Filler, both just because of patterns, like you said, experience. And then I also think that the break, they're playing big table 8-ball, right? Is it big table 8-ball?
Yeah,
is big that table correct? I mean, the break and big table 8-ball is almost all important. And we know where Justin's break and Filler's break are. And so the easier it is for either player, the easier it is to run out after the break, the more that tips to the guy that has the big break. And I just think if it is shoot either ball group, I think Filler's got such a big break and such a lot of firepower that there's just not going to be enough trouble on the table to slow that kid down. And so I'm assuming it's take what you make. I don't know. I think, you know, I'll find out. You'll find out. But I mean,
well, as of right now, I already know that it has not been discussed yet. They have not reached that level of negotiating for the match yet. That was as of yesterday.
And they're playing a race. Is it a race to 100 or a race to 80? A race to 80, right?
I think if you take breaking and running out of the game, I think the more you do that, the more it's going to favor Bergman. And I think if you have the combination of take what you make or take what you make the most of, I think that actually goes down to maybe even favoring Justin Bergman.
Well, I agree. But if they're playing open table after the break, all I'm saying is if they're playing a race to 80, Filler might get that job done in 5 innings.
Yeah.
So they better play. take what you make the most of.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it favors Filler heavily, unless those other rules that are basically designed to not put a lot of big packages together is implemented. Kind Agreed. Of a big equalizer. Rob, did you have any thoughts on it?
No, I agree with that too. Yeah. I got to go with Filler either way, but definitely if you straight eight ball, he's probably coming out on top on that one.
Yeah. So now we can, I guess, move on to the end of the podcast. So last week, we kind of challenged the listeners to write in questions, and it actually went pretty well. We had quite a few questions that were brought in, and I am going to be answering these on a first-come, first-serve basis until maybe we get a lot more. So we'll actually go in-depth on these, or, you know, pretty in-depth on these, and maybe in the future, we'll just kind of skim the surface if we get a bunch of them. But we'll start out with the first question that I had received. And this was from a player that says, basically, they didn't quite understand the idea of what throw does to a ball and what people mean by when they say throw the ball in the pocket, for example. So I think we should have a discussion on what outside spin being applied to the cue ball does to the object ball and how it can be used to help or maybe could even be used to hurt if you don't know how to use it properly. Your object ball that you're trying to shoot into the corner or, you know, to wherever. So does anybody want to take it away first?
Yeah, I'll kick us off. So throw has to do with how friction between the balls, between the cue ball and the object ball you're shooting at, how friction in between the balls can change the direction that the object ball goes. So, you know, when you first learn an aiming system, whether it's ghost ball, let's just say ghost ball, you say, hey, you shoot the object ball, you strike this contact point, and then the object ball moves along the line of centers, the line formed between the center of the cue ball and the center of the object ball. Basically, it follows it goes away from where the contact point is. The problem is when you're cutting an object ball, there are frictions involved. So if I'm cutting a ball to my left, the cue ball has friction when it contacts the object ball. It doesn't operate immediately and cleanly. It gets kind of pushed offline just a little bit. So if I'm cutting a ball to the left and I think I'm cutting it, you know, well, I'm not going to start getting into angles. If I'm cutting a ball to a left and I'm aiming at a target, it's going to act as if I've undercut the ball slightly because it's called, this is called directional throw. And because of the direction my cue ball is coming from, it pushes the object ball just slightly thicker than the cut line that I would aim. So that's directional throw. That basically, another way to say it is the tendency for the object ball to undercut. And of course, the things that maximize directional throw, the things that make that really, you know, visible are a softer speed coming across like a half ball hit and a rolling cue ball. So if I'm rolling the cue ball at soft speeds and that cue ball has a half ball hit, meaning I have enough angle to create some push, but I'm not hitting the ball so thinly, I'm still able to push through a lot of that ball. That's what magnifies that throw. On the other hand, shooting firm, thin or full and withdraw and the speed changes that. But now the English throw, this is the other kind of throw, is that when you're spinning the object or you're spinning the cue ball, that also can throw the object ball off the idea, you know, the envisioned trajectory. So now we'll go to a straight in shot and we'll say if you contact the ball straight on, you'd think it would go straight, but if you're spinning the cue ball with a bunch of left spin, And I'm assuming that you've adjusted for curve and deflection. You're able to hit the object ball full on so that the cue ball stops in place and is spinning like a stop shot, a spinning stop shot with the cue ball spinning like a top. That object ball, if I'm using a lot of left spin on the cue ball, that object ball will not go straight. It will go a little bit to the right of that the line I thought. And so that's English throw or side spin throw. And so things that maximize side. And so whatever spin you put on the object of the cue ball, the object ball is going to throw the opposite direction. If I put left spin on the cue ball, it's like gears. It's going to throw that object ball a little bit to the right because the front of the cue ball is going to grab the object ball and throw it offline. And so, and these are not huge amounts. You know, you're not going to see huge amounts, but it's definitely enough to make shots you couldn't otherwise make or miss shots you thought you were making. And so things that maximize side spin throw, again, softer speed. And we've also looked at the fact that there's a certain amount of side spin. People think that you can get maximum throw by spinning the cue ball like a top. It's actually not the case. You're actually better off using a little bit less side spin in a rolling cue ball, and that really maximizes the side spin throw. So what this means in practical play is that when you're cutting balls and using side spin, you have to kind of be aware of that. And it can be tricky because these things can cancel each other out. If I'm cutting a ball to the left, I'm using a little bit of right spin, which is outside English, then you can do what's called gearing, which is to use just enough side spin that the right spin on the cue ball throws the object ball enough to make up for the directional throw, pushing the object ball the other way. In other words, instead of pushing through the object ball, the cue ball is called gearing because the cue ball's got a little right spin and it rolls off the side of the object ball. And so there are times when you can use a little gearing to avoid missing. Or to avoid any kind of noticeable change to the throw line. But then there's many, you know, so it's a complicated subject because there's different kinds of throw, different conditions that can maximize them, and different times you can use them. I would recommend either reading Robert Burns' Standard Book of Pool and Billiards, which has a lot of great shots and diagrams and talks about what's going to happen here and here. It makes you actually think. And Dr. Dave has a great video series on this. But just in general, I'd say know that if you're using side spin, it is possible to, the spin, whatever spin you put on, it's going to throw the object ball off the aim line a little bit opposite to the spin you use in general. So there's my quick throw lesson.
Yeah. And
that amount could be, going, say you're all the way down one end of the long way on the table, you're shooting up into a corner pocket, and you're fairly close, maybe a foot away from the object ball. That can be, you can almost make a whole diamond worth of throw on there.
Well, and if you understand why that's happening, if you understand those basic principles, then you can start to at least learn from experience. But if you don't know what's happening, you'll never learn. But if you at least understand that, then as you start shooting shots, you can learn from experience. I really think that anybody that's going to be a student of the game needs to learn more. Straight pool, one pocket, all the rack games, you have to be able to maneuver at bar table, eight ball. There's just so many games where you have to be able to know how these things work. So if you didn't know more than what I just said, then you need to, get on Dr. Dave's website and read everything you can about throw.
I mean, there's not much that can be added to that. So what I'm going to do is tomorrow, I still have to do a bunch of videos. And tomorrow what I'll do is I'll throw in a throw video. And it's not going to be a super complicated one. I'm not going to cover all of the intricacies of that. They are already out there in existence. So what I'm going to do is probably just show the basics of what a throw shot does to a simple cut shot. What happens if you put, so if you have a ball on the bottom rail and you are cutting it to the right, let's just say at the second diamond on the bottom rail, what happens if you put left-hand spin on that? What happens if you put right-hand spin on it? And what happens basically if you hit center ball? So I'll do just a little tutorial video on how to start to be able to control your throw shots and what it does to the cue ball coming off of the rail and what it does to the ball that you're actually contacting. So I'll do that tomorrow. I'll try to get that out maybe by the end of the weekend. I'm starting to actually put a lot more work into these videos as far as editing and producing them as well. So they take a lot of work. It's actually incredible. I thought it kind of sucked doing editing podcasts when, for about an hour of podcasts, I have about 2.5 to 3 hours worth of editing and producing afterwards. These videos, it's like 1 hour video is like 12 hours of editing and producing. It sucks, but
and another half hour of whining. Oh,
yeah,
come on.
I know, right? So
yeah,
basically what I'm saying is it takes a while to get these things out.
You could always find a job.
You're right. I could.
Yeah. I don't have to worry about this anymore.
I don't know. It's not easy to be essential, Rob.
Hey, that's right. That's right. Essential. I'm not essential.
Trust me, man. It's not so easy. That's the wrong day. It's a good day to do podcasts.
I don't know. You guys are both trying to kick me out of them.
Well,
and now that I'm offended over here,
here's what I want you to do on this next one. You know, yeah, explain about all the throws and the type of spins and all that. Go ahead. But I want you to try on a video to skid a ball.
Oh, Rob, I wasn't going to say this, but now you said that, I got to tell you, I have a very cool shot I do where I put the one ball on the foot spot, the eight ball frozen behind it, like in a line.
Yep.
And I take my challenges to take ball in hand and shoot the eight ball directly into the corner. And, you know, there's a few ways to do this. Of course, you can jump over the one and land on the eight, but I'm talking just shoot it directly in the corner. And it doesn't look like it goes. It looks like you're going to be cutting it into the first diamond. So what I do is I say I get ball in hand, though. And so what I do is I take ball in hand. I cause a distraction. Maybe I drop the cue ball. And then while I'm picking up the cue ball, I have a chalk in my hand, and I put a big chalk mark, like grind the chalk on the cue ball, and put like a half a dime size, like a size of a Q-tip with the chalk right on the cue ball. And then I take ball in hand, and I wiggle the cue ball so it's almost Mickey Mouse, almost frozen to the cue, to the object balls, to the eight ball and the ball in the spot, but not frozen. It's not a foul. I never make it watch.
Okay.
Ball. And then I get it lined up so that chalk mark is between the cue ball and the eight ball. And so that there's about maybe a dime's width between the balls. So that way I know that the contact point will be with that chalk mark.
Right.
I aim at a half ball hit, apply a little bit of inside English. And my only time I miss that is if I undercut the ball and skid it all the way to the end rail. I mean, I skid that thing right in the hole. It's sick.
Yeah, that's
so
funny.
If you ever have ball in hand and the ball doesn't quite go, just drop the cue ball on the floor, chalk the sucker up, and wobble it. You know, trust me.
I've seen a guy do that shot with spit.
Yep, you do the opposite. You don't have any. But now I'll tell you this. Of course, everybody, I'm kidding. I'm not going to. That's cheating. Don't do that. But it does make a funny prop. So.
Yeah. Have you ever in your pool play career, either one of you guys, let me just ask you this question, because it has happened to me in a match. Have you ever missed a shot, but it skidded and you pocketed the ball?
You know what? I'll tell you this. I've got a lot of funny stories. I was playing a guy, and he was from out of town, and we were playing for a certain amount per set. And I won it. And this was on the toughest equipment in my home state. I was up two sets, and we doubled the bet. So now, of course, if I lose, we're even. If I win, I'm up a fair amount of jelly beans. And it went hill, and I had a cut shot where the nine ball was on the third and a half diamond on the side rail. And the cue ball was just, I was a little bit out in the middle. Like, I had to run it down the rail. I had to cut it and then run this thing down the rail. And this thing was like a snooker pocket. Like, this ball, you could barely shoot it. I mean, it was almost like you should bank it cross corner because running it down the rail was so hard.
Sure.
But I line it up, and I mean, I'm nervous. You know, I'm hill. I get down, you know, it's a big ball. And I overcut that ball.
And made it.
That ball, and I mean, I'm telling you, the pockets were so tight. It's like, you could hit this ball. It's so tough to make it. I overcut that ball. It skidded. It hopped, and it nutted right in the middle of that hole. And the funny part about it is, like, I think a lot of people didn't realize that, because then he pulls up and pays me off and quits. And everybody's talking about how clutch I am. And I'm like, that's right.
You got lucky.
Like, I dogged my brains out on that shot. And I'm like, that's right.
Yeah.
I just played it off. I'm like, I'm clutch. I'm clutch.
Yeah.
So I determined right then and there.
I side pocket. I overcut a ball by a half a diamond in the side one time. Made her in the center of the hole.
I decided after that shot I could never complain about skid again.
Right. Yeah, when it happens. Doesn't happen often in your favor, usually.
Yeah.
But when it does, it certainly is remarkable. But that's, you know, talking about skidding and talking about throwing and all that stuff, it all goes together. The skid is unusual, though, you could say.
Yeah.
A lot of factors have to come together perfectly for that to happen.
So that'll be our two tip segment for the week, as we're trying to potentially wean that out a little bit more in the coming weeks. We'll talk about listener questions instead of that. So that'll be installation number one of that. So from here, we can move on to Demetrius's Coach's Corner. Demetrius, why don't you take it away?
Fantastic. Welcome to another edition of the Coach's Corner. This is the part of the podcast where I get to share with you some tips that might hopefully make your pool journey more rewarding. Demetrius Gelatis here with mnpoolbootcamp.com. You can check me out online, www.mnpoolbootcamp.com, where I do training for players across the country that want to take their game to the next level. 3-day sessions, go home a different player. Okay, so this week I want to get back. I had a great question from a student that wanted to know one of the challenges, and this is a challenge we all face as we get better. What do you do when you're playing weaker players more and more often? How do you stay focused when you're playing weaker players? Because this player was explaining to me that they'd play really hard for the first, X number of games. Maybe it was 3 games, maybe it was 10, where they'd run out, beat the player. And then it seems like after a little while, they're like, okay, I beat this guy like a drum. I ran out a bunch of racks. Now, they just kind of lose focus. And then oftentimes they'd start playing down to the level of their opponent, and they would end up with a session that was just not as rewarding and not as fun. They're not getting better, and it's just kind of meh. And so they're like, what do I do? I know that there's something I got to be doing wrong here. And so this is a very important question because, like I said, as you get better, this is going to be more and more. So it's something I've struggled with a lot. So here's what I told them. I said, there's kind of a 2-pronged attack to this thing. The first thing is you have to understand, you have to be able to use a different fuel source. So this kind of speaks to a little bit about, I'll throw back to my last couple where I was talking about, process goals versus result goals. And this is a great time to talk about how that can be applicable, because if you have a result goal, which is to win, well, that just doesn't provide enough fuel because it doesn't really look like the outcome is a dealt. So then you're like, well, I'm going to win. So therefore, what's really pushing me if I'm not afraid of losing? And this is where if you have process goals where you're focused on trying to, play correctly or play good patterns, or if you're playing for other reasons. So, and this is not just about goals, it's also about motivation, but there's a lot of overlap between the two. What are you trying to do at the table? If you're just trying to win, then you're not asking for enough from yourself. So you really have to be focused on your process and find that as a goal. And then as far as the motivation, one thing that I've discovered, I'll tell you a story about where I discovered that playing weaker players can actually reveal a lot, is that when I grew up playing, players in my pool hall that were good did not play for fun. They all played for money, and they were contemptuous of fun. They thought they were above playing for fun. This was the 90s, and they would walk around and say things like, well, does a plumber go home and fix his bathtub for fun? And things like that. They just sneered about it. They wouldn't put their cue together for less than 100. And so I kind of grew up in that culture, and I was a money player. And then when I got a little bit older and not as many players wanted to play me for money, or I wanted to find different fuel sources for myself besides beating a guy and winning the cash. And so there was a period, though, where when I would play guys for practice, I might not play as well. I might play down to their level. I might not be as focused. I'd get lazy. I'd miss some shots. And then what the thought that would go through my head is I would be frustrated, and I'd be like, man, I would never have missed that ball. If I was playing for money, I would have made that ball. If I was playing for money, I would have run those balls. Like, when I'm playing for money, I've got pressure on me. I've got adrenaline pumping. My focus is higher. I'm in survival mode, and I just perform better. And so it was really when I would play poorly or when I'd make mistakes, it would be very easy to dismiss those and to be irritated to like, man, if I just wish I could give this guy a spot and we could bet something, and I wouldn't have missed that ball. And that's not a good attitude. And I'll admit that I had that, thought, because I was trying to learn a different way. But one day I made a discovery that changed the way I look at playing for fun. And what that discovery was that while it's true that I would probably play better for money, I still made mistakes and missed balls. And so then the question came up, why that ball? Why that mistake? I understand that I'm not going to play as good playing for fun, but why when I play bad, why was it that that was the shot I missed and that was the way I missed it? And what I started to discover was my game has strengths and weaknesses. And so while it's true that with more hunger in my belly, I might have been able to overcome those weaknesses. You know, when I'm playing for fun and I lose focus, I didn't lose focus and make mistake A. I didn't lose focus and make mistake B because I'm so good at A and B, but that's just not where I broke down. But when I made mistakes X, Y, and Z, if I missed a certain type of shot or if I made, you know, misplayed a certain type of position, how come I misplayed that type of position? And what I realized was, yes, it's true that if I'd been betting, maybe I wouldn't have made that mistake. Still showed me that that was the weakest point of my game. Because my game broke down somewhere, and that's where it happened to break down. And then furthermore, I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, it's true that I typically play better under pressure. There are also times that I don't play well under pressure. Pressure can go both ways. It can make you play better, and it can also make you play worse. It accentuates what you're feeling. And so, yes, a lot of times my best pool that I've ever played has been under pressure. But also some of the worst pool I've ever played has been under pressure. And I've had some glorious meltdowns. And I realized that when I'm under a lot of pressure and I don't perform, then my game breaks down in very, very similar spots to where it breaks down when I'm playing for fun against weaker players. And that was really, really eye-opening to me to realize I can't simply say I would have made that if I was playing in a tournament. Instead, I have to say if I was playing in a tournament and really, really fighting in the finals and feeling a lot of doubt and fear and nerves, I bet you I would have made the exact same mistake. And so I started looking at playing for fun as a simulation for playing under pressure when it wasn't a good pressure, when I was fighting. And I used that as a litmus test for saying, as a really like a black light to expose the flaws in my game, to say, I know I can play good for money when I'm feeling good, but how do I play when I'm breaking down? This is a good simulation for how I play when I'm breaking down. And it allowed, and I, so I started taking, once I had that shift in mindset, it allowed me to take it way more seriously because I can't just dismiss this and say I wouldn't make that mistake playing for cash. It's like, yes, I might, and I need to work on these. So that was the process goal that I set, and that was the motivation I used, which is this is the way I will play when I'm playing under pressure at times, and therefore my process goal is to try to work on these leaks right here, right now, so that I can win when I get in the ring. The only other thing that I would say, so that was the two-pronged attack. That was the main point, which is under, you know, shifting your motivation and shifting your goals, being motivated by understanding that this is going to mimic your finals performance sometimes, and then focusing on the process of where you break down. As far as the other prong, it's pretty simple, which is that you have to adjust your expectations to reality. A lot of what I talk about, my whole mental game approach is a reality-based approach, reality-based. A lot of players aren't realistic. And so what I mean by that is, you have to adjust your expectations to reality. So if you believe champion player is somebody that when they're in the clutch can dig deep, kick up their game, and come with some amazing shots and play some inspired pool, and I think most of us believe that, then you can't also say that a champion is always consistent, because consistency and elevating your game during the clutch contradict each other. If a champion is supposed to be consistent, then that means that they don't elevate their game in the clutch. They play the same way all the time. But if they can elevate their game in the clutch, then that implies that that's a level of play that they don't always bring. And so you can't have the best of both worlds. And so I do believe that we're all humans and we're not robots and we're not champions because we always play perfect. But we're champions because we get the job done in the clutch a lot of the time, not all the time, but that we also play hard all the time and play, you know, fairly steady. But so what I'm saying is that we can't expect ourselves to play as good playing weaker opponents and playing for fun as we will when we're playing opponents that are better when it matters to us and we know that we can't get away with a mistake. You can't expect from yourself the same level of performance. It's not realistic. So if you do expect that from yourself, then you're going to be very frustrated, and whatever problems you have on the table are going to be exasperated by your frustration, your impatience, your self-criticism, this negative spiral of you know, setting the bar where you can't hit it. So I would just say, be a little patient and tolerant with yourself, and know that while you can shift your goals to process goals, and while you can use for motivation this idea that this is going to be how you play in the finals someday when you're struggling, that's great. But then you also have to be patient with yourself and understand that it's probably not going to equate to the same level of output as if you were in a tournament playing a good player. And so you could try your hardest to patch up those leaks. But when you don't always do it, be a little patient with yourself and budget for that, so that you're not adding to your leaks by adding a layer of frustration, disappointment, and criticism. All these things don't spawn into better play. So, and then one recommendation. So that's the tips on how would I do it. Adjust your expectations to lower your expectations just a little, and then try your best to make the best of a tough situation. My last tip that has nothing to do with this, but this goes back to managing your career, which is, this is why it's important to manage your career. Because while it's true that you're going to put in some time playing on your own, while it's true you're going to put in some time playing weaker players, you can't play weaker players all the time and realistically expect to improve and push yourself. And so while it's definitely, you need to put in hours and you need to play better players, and you can't always get both the hours and the better players the same. You can't always play 20 hours a week against better players, but that's, if you can only play against better players 2 hours a week, then you can get your hours playing against the weaker players, but you got to make sure you get your time against the better players when you can. So when you play weaker players, adjust your expectations to reality, do your best to make the best of a tough situation by motivating yourself, understanding this is going to be your finals performance, using this as a spotlight on the weaker parts of your game. But then also plan for that and make sure that that's not the entirety of your pool time. That's what I've got on that. So great question. Thank you very much. Any questions, you can email me directly at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com. Thanks again.
Absolutely.
Good, coach.
Lots of good stuff in there. All right, fellows. Well, another week has come to an end.
Guys and girls, all I can say is keep stroking.
All right. Till next week, guys.
See you guys.